Thank you all so much for coming to learn with me. I'm going to try and move a little bit slower. I'm glad that we broke up this first section, which is really a history of the Torah, that we broke it up into two classes. We left off last time, previously, from Mesopotamia to Manhattan. We left off with the entrance of the Jewish people into the land of Israel. Just to recap, Moshe Rabbeinu, the leader of the Jewish people, passes away. God allows Moshe to get a glance, a look at the land of Israel. And Moshe prays intently. Our rabbis tell us that in Parshat Va'etchanan, that when Moshe davened, when he prayed to enter into the land of Israel, he prayed over 515 prayers, desperate to perhaps avert the decree that he was destined to not enter into the land of Israel. And God says that Aleil Hara Varim, you're allowed to go up to this mountain on the other side, and from this mountain on the other side, you're going to be able to see. You'll get a look at all of the land of Israel. There's a rabbinic tradition that had Moses entered into the land of Israel, that would have essentially been the end of history. That would have been the ushering in of the Messianic era. That would have been another shot. But Moses was destined to die off with the rest of his generation in the desert. And he's buried somewhere over here in Harei Adom, where you see the red over here. Moshe was granted a
part of my backpack.
Was granted a glimpse. I'm just going to, of course, I always forget to do this. I'm going to mute. I'm going to mute everybody, but I also want to encourage people, if you have any questions, to unmute yourself and to ask. It's very much welcome, especially with the smaller group on this holiday weekend. The Jewish people continue on after Moshe Rabbeinu passes away. Moshe Rabbeinu is the name that we give to Moshe traditionally, which means Moses, our teacher. And the Jewish people continue on. You could see their path over here on this red line. And they find themselves at the cusp of entering the land of Israel, right where my cursor is on the Jordan River. And we touched upon this a little bit in the previous class. I just want to describe to you a little bit what the scene was when the Jewish people are getting ready to cross. Joshua, Moses' faithful student, prepares to lead the people in. And the Talmud tells us, it's in Tractate Megillah, in Masechet Megillah, the Talmud tells us there was another splitting of a body of water. So if anybody tells you that the Jews only crossed one body of water on their way to the Promised Land, it's not true. They crossed two bodies of water, this time the Jordan River. And there's an amazing Talmudic passage that says that the way that the Jordan River was split was that they went in towards the middle and the waters stopped, meaning the waters that were coming down, flowing down the Jordan River, they went straight up. The Talmud says that they even went up into space, it reached. And the rest of the Jordan River, as the water flowed down, the rest of the Jordan River dried up. And the Jewish people were able to cross over on dry land. And they ended up somewhere right around over here, which would be current day Jericho, if you've ever been on that road, or if you've ever taken the turn down from Jerusalem heading towards the hotels of the Dead Sea, you've definitely passed this spot. And they cross over, and the first place that they land is Gilgal, is the place of Gilgal, which is going to be significant later on, because in Gilgal was another place that the Mishkan, that the tabernacle, had been pitched. And the Jewish people go, and after a number of battles, some of them more famous than others, you're probably familiar with Joshua and the walls of Jericho. That famously, God tells the Jewish people in the first fortified city that they encounter in the Promised Land. Here's a better picture over here where you see the blue, where it says Binyamin. So Yericho is right over here. They crossed over right over here on this image. And in Yericho, the city was fortified. It was surrounded by walls. And the Jewish people and the armies of Joshua surrounded the walls. They marched around it seven times and the walls of Jericho fell. And that was the beginning of the conquering of the land of Israel. And Joshua's job after the conquering of the land of Israel was to ensure that the land was divided to each of the tribes. We discussed a little bit last time how the division of the land was something that was done with forethought, was done according to families. We have a famous passage in the Torah. I actually named my daughter after one of the daughters of Tzelafchad. There were five daughters that asked Moses the question about what happens if a man dies and only leaves daughters. And daughters were also to inherit in the land of Israel as well in that case. And you could see that we have two and a half tribes, Reuven, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh that inherit land on the other side of the Jordan River, what we call the Transjordan. And the rest of the tribes settle in the land of Israel proper, leaving the land to the Philistines, which is later on conquered. After number of battles, the Philistines were a constant thorn in the eyes of the Jewish people during their initial settlement in the land of Israel. And we also mentioned that the temple, Jerusalem, was situated right between the tribes of Benjamin and Judah, which is where my cursor is right now. And Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, sat right at the cusp of this. In fact, the Talmud tells us that so close were the borders of Benjamin and Judah that the temple was bisected by the border between these two tribes. The last thing I think that we mentioned last week is that there was also one tribe that did not receive a portion in the land per se, and that was Moses' very own tribe, the Levites. The Levites, because their job was to work in the temple and to be the spiritual leaders and teachers of the Jewish people, and they did not take part in the battles or the conquering of the land. They were not called out to war. Their job was strictly spiritual pursuits. So the Levites were residing, they were city dwellers. They were only urban dwellers, and their cities were scattered throughout the land of Israel, and the tribe of Shimon, of Simeon, was completely surrounded by the tribe of Judah, the strongest tribe and the most volatile tribe, as it were, like we said, I think it's Lesotho is that country in South Africa that's completely landlocked. So this is a picture of the first conquering of the land of Israel. We call that Kibush Rishon, the first conquering. There's going to be a number of successive conquerings of the land of Israel, adding sanctity, adding holiness to the land of Israel. Each successive conquering and occupation by the Jewish people of the lands that they've conquered and the nations that they've defeated, so each one of those confers an added level of sanctity to the land of Israel. Significantly, you'll notice that right over here, basically where you would find like Maktesh Ramon, the Ramon crater, that Negev part was not part of the initial conquering of the land of Israel. I described to somebody, I was on a bus. It is sanctified nowadays, although it's an interesting halachic discussion. I remarked to somebody, I was once on a bus, it was very late at night, and you know, I was in this like semi-conscious state, and the bus crossed over in the desert. We were driving all the way to Eilat, as tourist buses do, and like I felt in my bones something, I felt something in my body that like leaving biblical Kibush Rishon, first conquering Israel, and descending into the deep Negev, which is only sanctified much, much later on, that something palpable, something changes, and something is different. Let's move on. So after the Jewish people conquer and defeat the seven Canaanite nations, they are traveling with a temple. The temple, the Mishkan, the tabernacle, was this portable temple that had traveled around with the Jewish people in the desert during their 40-year sojourn there. Of course, the Torah dedicates a lot of time to discussing the tabernacle and all of its accoutrements, all of the different kelim, the vessels that exist in it, the construction of the walls and the curtains called yiriot in Hebrew. And you have here a pretty good diagram. I'll just show you what the diagram looks like first in the tabernacle, which was designed to be built and taken apart. The people that were responsible for that construction and destruction of the Mishkan and then building it back up again and also assigned to carrying it was none other than the Levites. So you'll notice, famously, we have Hanukkah coming up. We have a menorah. A menorah is a little bit different than our Chanukiot, technically, that we light on Hanukkah. The menorah that was in the temple and in the tabernacle had only seven branches to it. And let's point out some other ones. So here's the outside of it, where my cursor is. Just to give me a thumbs up, can you guys see the cursor that I'm using on the screen? Excellent. So, and I'm trying to slow myself down. Remember that we do have time here. So around the side, you could see these little poles. This is a pretty good one. So we call those the krashim. Those are that's the frame of the Mishkan. The krashim are surrounded with curtains. There's an opening curtain by the entrance, the masach. And then you come in, there's an outer area, a courtyard, as it were. And when you go inside, you have what is called the kodesh, the sanctum. And in the sanctum, you have the menorah, you have a golden altar that is in the outside, you have another bronze altar that is beyond that, you have the shulchan, the table that the showbread was placed on. Every week there would be, before the Sabbath, there would be 12 loaves of bread that would be placed there, would miraculously stay fresh for the rest of the week, only to be replaced at the morrow of the coming Sabbath. And then when you go inside, there's something called a parochet. And the parochet you might know or might be familiar with, because when you enter into a synagogue nowadays, and all synagogues are essentially patterned after the tabernacle or the Beit HaMikdash, which is why in rabbinic parlance, traditional parlance, our synagogues are called a Mikdash Me'at, a small temple, a microcosm of what the temple was, a place for serving God. So the parochet led us into the Kodesh HaKedoshim, called the Sancta Sanctorum, the Holy of Holies, and inside that were the most sacred parts of the tabernacle, the sacred parts of our service of God. Inside, you could see where my cursor is, there was the Aron, there was the Ark of the Covenant. Inside the Ark of the Covenant were the tablets and the broken tablets of Moses, and there were Kruvim on top of it, there were cherubs on top of it, the image of a boy and a girl with wings that were on top of it, and this was the holiest place. Only the high priest, only the Kohen Gadol, Aaron HaKohen, Aaron the high priest and his descendants were the only people allowed to enter into this place at appointed times. Anybody else who would enter into this kind of a place would be liable to pay with their lives. This was the holiest place inside the Mishkan. The Mishkan found a few resting places in Israel, but the most important resting place of the Mishkan, where it was for many, many years before the construction of the Beit HaMikdash, of the actual temple, was in these mountainous areas, which is the city of Shiloh. And the city of Shiloh, this is actually a real picture of Shiloh with the Mishkan, a little bit more permanent, a little bit more situated with stones and not meant anymore to be constructed and deconstructed and moved around with the Jewish people. And the tabernacle is situated at Shiloh, and you see essentially what it looks like on the outside. And the whole inner sanctum, right, the whole Kodesh and Kodesh HaKedoshim was covered with animal skins and finery, and this is where people would come to. I've actually been at this spot. This spot is famous because I mean, it's famous because it's where the tabernacle was, where the Mishkan was. But I'll tell you a wonderful story about it, and I'll stop sharing so I could see you guys. Hi, everybody. We went there, and there is a spot. If you go to Shiloh, which is a settlement in Israel, if you go there, they'll show you that they have a pretty solid idea where the actual spot of the prayer of Chana was. Now, we'll just interrupt the history, tell you the story of Chana. The high priest at the time was none other than Eli HaKohen. And Eli HaKohen, he had two sons who were not great people. They were accused of taking bribes and all kinds of terrible things and defiling the sanctity of the tabernacle. And there was a lady who showed up at the tabernacle one day, as many pilgrims were wont to do, and she is praying there. And she is praying with such intensity. She's praying with her mouth moving, talking to somebody or something, that Vayachshevel Ishikora. Eli thinks that she must be intoxicated. She's drunk. What is she doing here? And instead of being drunk, she says, "No, Ishamarat Nefesh Ani. I'm a woman of bitter spirit. I'm of embittered spirit." And what was the bitterness that Chana had? Chana's bitterness was that she was one of two wives, and she was unable to have children. And she's praying for a child, the most impassioned prayer that she could muster. And she is promised by Eli at this time, she's promised by Eli HaKohen that God will answer her prayers. Not only does God answer her prayers, but Chana's prayer becomes the model for all prayer, for all time. The Talmud tells us we learn three things from Chana's prayer. One is that you have to enunciate. Another is that you can't enunciate it too much. You can't speak too louder, and that you also have to pray with intention. You have to pray with kavanah. And Chana demonstrates all of these things, davening for a child, and that child is Shmuel HaNavi. In the pantheon of prophets that we're going to talk about when we have our next class and we discuss the canon, the 24 books of the Tanakh, in the pantheon of prophets, it basically goes Moshe, Aharon, and then Shmuel. We say this on Friday night in our tefillah, Moshe v'Aharon b'cho hanav, u'Shmuel b'korei shemo, that Samuel, Shmuel, is considered just below Moses and Aaron in the scale of prophecy. And Shmuel is significant because he is the one who anoints, who basically marks the beginning of the next period of Jewish history, which is the period of kings. But I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. But the place of Chana's prayer, Makom Tfilat Chana, is now a site. You could visit it and you could daven and you could pray to Hashem in that exact space. And another interesting thing is that when I was in the spot, when I went to Shiloh, when I visited, You wonder how in such a small area, how the entire Jewish people could gather on the Shalosh Regalim, the three festivals, where the Jewish people are enjoined to be seen and to see God and to come to temple. That is the Shavuot, Sukkot, Pentecost, Tabernacles, and Pesach and Passover. And when you look around, it's actually, if you got a 360-degree view, you would see that it's kind of like a stadium point of view, that on all the mountains around, on the hills of all the mountains, you could easily put an entire nation observing and observing the process of the service of the holidays, of these festivals, and also coming to visit, which is something that we're going to see later on, which is where the temple is situated as well. It's kind of not the highest mountain, but it's a mountain that's situated and surrounded by all these other mountains. So this is the tabernacle in Shiloh, and the tabernacle is the last stage before the temple. Now, before I get to the temple, Joshua marks the beginning of the period of prophets after Moses. After Joshua, we have a period that's called the period of the Shoftim. Before we get to the temple, I'll stop sharing and I'll talk a little bit about that. The period of the Shoftim are the judges of Israel. Israel goes through a period of time after their initial conquering of the land of Israel. There's still some battles to be fought. Most famous of the judges, you might be familiar with Deborah the Shofetet, the prophetess, Deborah HaNeviah, a female leader of the Jewish people, and there is Gideon, who is also another great leader. There's Ehud. These are Shoftim. Another more important Shofet is Samson. Can't leave out Samson. And these are people who are both judges and military leaders of the Jewish people. The last of the Shoftim is Shmuel. Samuel is the final one of the Shoftim. And Samuel is approached by the people. And the people are begging him for a king. They're begging him for a ruler who should lead us, come before us, just like all the other nations. And therein, in that request, lies the fallacy of the people's request for a king. When I teach this in school, we learn this in sixth grade and bicultural. We begin the book of Shmuel. And one of the central questions that we have when we get up to, I think it's like the third or fourth chapter of the book of Shmuel, is having a king a good thing or a bad thing? And is it a positive? Is it a negative for the Jewish people? Certainly, God, it's something that God grants, but the way that God grants having kings to the Jewish people is one of, sort of like when a child begs you for something that you know is not really good for them, but you kind of want them to learn the lesson about this thing. That's what a king was for the Jewish people. Shmuel tells them, he says, you're going to get what you're asking for, but you're not going to like it. Your sons are going to be impressed into service in the army. Your daughters are going to have to serve as domchei lechima, as battle supports and maid servants in the temple. And the king is going to be able to appropriate by eminent domain any of your land, and he's going to be able to levy taxes and essentially do what he wants. Now, of course, the Jewish king is different in the sense that the Jewish king has a king above them, and the king above them is God. And that's why there's certain rules about a Jewish king. A Jewish king has to carry a Sefer Torah, a small Sefer Torah with them at all times. They must carry a Torah scroll with them at all times to remember God. A Jewish king cannot have too many wives, can't have too big of a, I think harem is the word, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. It can't have too big of a coterie of wives. A king also, a Jewish king is enjoined to not have too many horses, lo yarbelo susim. The reason for that being that besides being an indicator of wealth and power and placing one's faith in that wealth and power is the sense that the king needs to be humbled before God. So that even the Jewish king has a ruler. Enter into the period of the kings. The first of the Jewish kings does not come from the tribe of Judah. The first of the Jewish kings comes from the tribe of Benjamin. His name is King Saul. King Saul rules for 2 years. He is a reluctant king. Samuel anoints him, and he is described as being both physically and spiritually head and shoulders above the rest of the people, which is not a good look for a Jewish king because he is seen as aloof, as different, as separate from all the people, and his reign does not end well. And the next king of the Jewish people is the most famous of all Jewish kings, which is King David. David HaMelech is the first king from the tribe of Judah, as all true kings will be from then out. And David HaMelech is most well known to us for being the author of the book of Psalms, for the Tehillim that David HaMelech wrote throughout a life of trials and tribulations and ordeals. We just had a lesson today in the high school where we talked about in a Yom Iyun, a day of study, we talked about the significance of King David's Psalms. Many people have been reciting Psalms for the situation in Israel. What exactly is the point of that is maybe a class for another time. During the pandemic, I gave 17 classes for Lincoln Square on Psalms. I'm happy to send you a link to those classes. And King David fights wars of Israel. He does battle again and again and again with the Philistines. He's most famous in battle for killing Goliath, who came from the Philistines, Goliath. And David is this wonderful, unbelievable soul who contains all these multitudes. And we find, and I said today, we find in his Psalms expression of the gamut of human emotion, of humanity, love, desire, triumph, depression, betrayal. All of these things find their way into the Psalms that King David wrote, which is something that every Jewish person, really every person of faith in all religions, have been able to access for eternity. That's what King David does, and it becomes his calling card. And King David does not, he desires to build the temple, but he does not build the temple. And now we could go back to our slides. It's King David's son, Solomon, who is the one who is allowed and given the power of building the temple. The image on the right over here is a more or less accurate picture, depiction of the first temple of Solomon. The first temple of Solomon, we're learning in eighth grade right now, it is, it's wondrous. It was the most beautiful building in the world, which is what the second temple is described as by Josephus. It is patterned after the Mishkan, patterned after the tabernacle, but not quite the same thing. There's some curious elements to it, which I'll just point out to you. You have these two pillars in the front, which had the names Yachin and Boaz. They're made out of bronze, copper, excuse me. And then you also have this rather curious laver, this bowl over here, which is called the Molten Sea. Very mysterious what it is. There are 12 oxen that are underneath it. And then you could see the curtains, much like in the tabernacle. And inside you had the inner sanctum that contained all of the special kelim, the accoutrements, the vessels of the temple. Many of them were fashioned anew by Solomon. He did not use the old ones from the tabernacle. And this became the permanent resting place of God's presence, the permanent home of God, until, of course, it was destroyed. But it was a building of splendor. This area around this courtyard is called the Azara, and you could see the large altar on the outside. Solomon, the description in chapter 6 and 7 of the book of Kings talk to us about the construction of the temple. There were 30,000 workers that would work in rotations of 20,000 with 10,000 being off in order to bring down cedars of Lebanon. Solomon's time in Israel was a time of unprecedented tranquility, of unprecedented wealth and opulence. The whole world would send tribute to Solomon and to his temple. The cedar and the cypress that was used to build the temple and to construct the flooring came from the forests of Lebanon and were formed through a pact between Solomon and Hiram, king of Tyre. And they were brought down, they were floated down actually in the Mediterranean, and they were brought for the construction of Solomon's temple. The first temple ends in destruction, and I'll tell you how we got to that. Let me see, just before we get to the next slide. Yeah, before we get to the next slide, if you'll permit me for a second to talk to you about what happens. Now, Solomon is also known for a request he makes of God. At the beginning of his rule, at the beginning, make sure that his rule is solidified. There's a brother or two that try to usurp the throne before him. Most significantly, his brother Adoniah, who is a pretender to the throne, and is famous for requesting sanctuary by holding on to the horns of the altar, lest Solomon kill him. He ends up getting killed. And Solomon requests from God wisdom. And the wisdom he requests from God is actually phrased in the most beautiful way. And I'll just tell you this parenthetically. It's not part of the history. Solomon asks God for a lev shomea, a listening heart. Solomon does not ask for wisdom. What Solomon asks for is the ability to listen and to judge the people properly. And God is so moved by this request that not only does he grant him the wisdom to understand even the conversations of the animals, the conversations of nature, but Solomon is granted wealth, power, quiet, tranquility. what's amazing to me is that he uses this time, he uses this period of peace, not to rest on his laurels, but to immediately get to work, to immediately start the gargantuan, enormous task of constructing this first temple. After Solomon dies, he has a son, Rehavam. Rehavam, if anybody could tell me the answer to this, I don't know why, but in the sizes of bottles of wine, it's really a list of the first kings of Israel and Judah. You have there's apparently like you go from a regular bottle of wine to a magnum, and then after a magnum is a Jeroboam, and a Jeroboam is apparently like huge 3.75 liter bottle of wine, and it's named after another person who was an adjunct of Rehavam, and this adjunct's name is Yeravam. Yeravam is supremely talented. He's a overseer of work. He's a subordinate of Rehavam, the son of Solomon. And Yeravam sees the opulence of Solomon's kingdom. He sees the decadence of it, and he hears the griping of the people, and through a series of events ends up splitting off. And he takes 10 tribes. Let's go back to the picture of Israel as it's divided to the tribes. Maybe that's a slide back. Here we go. So eventually, Yeravam splits the kingdom between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. In the southern kingdom, you have just the tribes of Benjamin and Judah. And in the northern kingdom, you have the 10 tribes of the north. I guess Shimon somehow is subsumed and included with them. These 10 tribes are now part of the northern kingdom, which is called Israel, the kingdom of Israel. And the two tribes in the bottom, Benjamin and Judah, are the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom splits off so decisively that Yeravam decides he doesn't want people to go down to the temple. So what he does is he constructs two temples. There's one in Shechem, and there's one in Dan, in the north over here, where my cursor is. And you would think that the Jewish people got the picture in the Torah, but the scene of worship at these temples was a golden calf. And you might be thinking to yourself, what was he thinking? What he was thinking is that if people went down to the Beit HaMikdash, if they went down to the temple that was in the tribe of Benjamin and Judah, that they would remember old allegiances, that they would remember old loyalties, and that they would rejoin the kingdom. And Rehavam and his son, Aviah, try desperately to reunite the kingdom. There is a major battle between 800,000 warriors of the northern kingdom and 400,000 warriors of the southern kingdom. But the battle actually results in a victory for the southern kingdom. The warriors emerge victorious. That's in the 11th chapter of the Book of Kings. And they have skirmishes over the border, which is right around here, where you could see where Dan, Ephraim, and Binyamin intersect. But the kingdoms will never be rejoined again until the time of the Messiah. The kings of the northern kingdom are almost to a person, wicked, idolatrous, and do not follow in the ways of God. That's the way that the Tanakh, the way that the Torah describes all of them. They didn't follow in the ways of God. This one didn't follow in the ways of God. You're probably most familiar with King Ahab and his wife Jezebel, he was a king of the north. And because of that, as history progresses, the 10 tribes of the north are expelled from the land. They're dispersed by the Assyrian king Sanherib. Sanherib disperses them. There's a tradition that they are dispersed over a mystical river, Sambation. And in modern Israel nowadays, since the founding of the State of Israel, one of the interesting ways that history has kind of folded onto itself is that we have all kinds of movements of the return of the lost tribes. You may have heard, for example, for the B'nai Menashe, a tribe that comes from, I think, Myanmar or the Himalayas, who came to Israel, and they claim to be from the tribe of Ephraim. They're Jews now. It makes no difference to us. They're Jews. And the Ethiopian Jewry. So there were those that claimed that the Ethiopian Jewry are descendants of one of the tribes of Dan. Makes no difference. They're full Jews. They're Jews. They're just like us Jews. And we have this movement of people that are locating these lost tribes and bringing them back to the land of Israel. And some people see this as part of the end of history, history coming closer to the advent of the Messianic era. But these 10 tribes are dispersed by Sanherib. Later on, some years later, the prophets Jeremiah and then Ezekiel and before them Isaiah foretell of the destruction of the temple, the real temple in the southern kingdom. And that temple is destroyed. Isaiah is the prophet of destruction and consolation. Jeremiah foretells, he tries to give the last warnings to the people to improve their ways, lest the temple be destroyed. And Ezekiel is the prophet who sees the destruction and prophesies with the Jewish people in Babylonia and prophesies their eventual return. These prophecies of destruction are difficult, although they also give to us some of our most iconic verses. For example, at Jewish weddings, we'll say, Odi Shama Be'are Yehuda Uvechutzot Yerushalayim, the words of Jeremiah. We will sing again, the words of Ezekiel, sorry. We will sing again in the streets of Judah and Jerusalem, and we'll hear the sounds of joy and mirth, the celebrations of brides and grooms. These verses of consolation of Isaiah form the bulk of our Haftarot in the summer, the reading after the Torah reading from the prophets. And the Jewish people leave the land of Israel, although it's for a short period of time. Let's move on to the next stage in Jewish history. The next stage in Jewish history after the destruction of the temple is the initial diaspora. So significant for the diaspora is that the Jewish people go to two major areas. The first major area that they go to is right over here where my cursor is, which is Babylonia. And you can notice some of the cities over here. By the Euphrates River, you have Sura and Pumbedisa. Sura and Pumbedisa are the two major academies of Jewish learning in Babylon, and it's where the Babylonian Talmud is developed and flourishes. At the same time, we find Jewish communities in Alexandria. Tzom Gedalia, the Fast of Gedalia, is actually commemorating an event that happens after the destruction, when the last remnant of the Jewish people in that first destruction are kicked out of the land. And we find that the Jewish people begin their path, their peregrination around all of the Roman Empire at the time. There's a Jewish community that makes it to Italy. Rome is one of the oldest Jewish communities in existence. But the Babylonian Talmud is formed over here. And after the Babylonian Talmud, we'll find the period of the Geonim. The Geonim were major yeshivas, but we're also getting ahead of ourselves. After 70 years, there's an important holiday that happens at that time, which is the Purim holiday. The Jewish people thwart destruction by the wicked Haman at the Esther, and Mordechai are able to do that. And they return back to the land of Israel to construct the second temple. And here's an image of the second temple. The second temple, the temple of Herod, was different in a number of ways. The initial construction was done by Ezra and Nehemiah, two of the final prophets. They lead the people back from Babylon to the land of Israel. Many Jews remain in Babylon. They refuse to come up to the land of Israel. However, they construct the second temple. Later on, the second temple is refined, built even bigger by Herod. Josephus says it's the most beautiful building in the world, almost unimaginable in its beauty and finery. And we still have remnants of it. I would say that this wall over here, if I'm looking at the map oriented right, that is what remains of it, our Western Wall. Although you could still go down into the temple tunnels, into the city of David, where the archaeological evidence of a Jewish monarchy is immense. We have coins that we've found with the names of people who are mentioned in Tanakh, mentioned in Scripture, but that's what we'll talk about next time. So we have this initial return. The Jewish people come back and they build the second temple, and that temple is destroyed by the Romans. The temple is just, I made a mistake before. After the second temple is when we find the Jewish people finally are kicked out for good, and they make their way around the rest of the world. The Jewish community is centered as it moves past Babylonia and the period of the Geonim. They find their way to Spain, to North Africa, and eventually to France, and to what would later on become Germany, to Byzantium, the Holy Roman Empire. And let's just take a look at this map for a second. Famously, we have the flourishing of Jewish learning and Jewish academies in Spain, France, and all the way up even to England. We have the Rishonim. The period of the Rishonim is the first period of commentaries. People are commenting on the Talmud, as the development of the oral tradition expands exponentially. And the main people at this time are Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, who lives in France and is a vintner in what would be modern day France, and his descendants and their academies, also known as the Tosafists. Their commentary on Gemara, their commentary on the Talmud, is a standard commentary printed in every single Talmud. On one page, you have Rashi, and on one side, you have Rashi, and the other side, you have the Tosafists. They flourish for a period of about 200 years. We have also Maimonides. We have Nachmanides, some of the greatest Jewish minds, Jewish thinkers of all times. Part of our miracle is that these words are studied today with intensity and reverence, the same way as the day that they were written, except for maybe Maimonides, who is somewhat of a controversial figure at his time. But I don't want to get too granular. We could have a whole series of shiurim on Maimonides, probably something I would like to do in the future. The Jewish people are expelled from Portugal, from Spain, the Spanish Inquisition, the auto de fe by the Catholic Church, expels 160,000 Spanish Jews, and they make their way to areas. They join Jewish communities in North Africa, and Maimonides himself finds his way back in Egypt, where he becomes the physician to Suleiman, to the leader of the caliphate at the time. And we have Ottoman Jewry. Jews make their way all around the world, Saloniki, and this is the beginning of Jewish life in Europe. Jewish life in Europe flourishes for about a thousand years. And let's move on to the next thing. So just to show you on this timeline, this is one of my favorite timelines as we approach the end of this. I mentioned the period of the Geonim, we have the period of the Rishonim, rough cutoff at about 1500. And as the Jewish people spread around and establish themselves in North Africa, in the Levant, and also in Europe, they have the period of the Achronim. The Achronim are commentators, on commentators. In between is a period of codification. The Shulchan Aruch is written, the main book of Jewish law, the main codification of Jewish law, which was written by Rav Yosef Karo, was actually written in the land of Israel. I should hasten to say, at all this time, there's still a Jewish community, there's still Jewish life in the land of Israel. It flourishes in the 15th century, in the 16th century, in the north of Israel, in the Galil. There is an awakening of Kabbalah, of the study of Jewish mysticism in the city of Tzfat, in the north of Israel, under the leadership, 2 years that he lived there, of the Arizal, Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, and his followers and disciples, Rabbi Chaim Vital. And they establish an entire body of Jewish teachings and Jewish mysticism. And this leads us up to our day and age, which is modernity. Jewish modernity is a long story. It's about a 600-year-old story. In 1666, owing to pogroms, expulsions, destructions of Jewish communities, and the constant feeling that we were never quite safe in the diaspora, in 1666 is the culmination of a messianic fervor that's led by none other than this fellow over here in this engraving, which was Shabtai Tzvi, who is notable for being one of the most important false messiah of the Jewish people. He had a prophet, Nathan of Gaza, who was a Kabbalist, a formidable Kabbalist, who espoused the teachings of Shabtai Tzvi, formed the doctrine of this intensely charismatic figure. We have memoirs of people at the time that talk about, I think Gluckel of Hameln talks about her father and people around in Germany selling all their possessions to follow Shabtai Tzvi, who would go and would conquer, he would convert the caliph in Constantinople. He would convert him to Judaism, Shabtai Tzvi goes there and he's promptly given a choice, convert to Islam or die. And he converts to Islam. He's mitaslem, one of my favorite Hebrew words. He converts to Islam, and the Sabbatean movement ends in disgrace. It should be said, there are people who believe that he only had a cursory conversion to Islam, and he's an occultation. There's even communities of people like that nowadays that are called the Donmeh, small communities of people who still follow the teachings of Shabtai Tzvi. And Shabtai Tzvi, one of his main ideas was the abrogation of Torah. After Shabtai Tzvi, in response to the degradations of the Chalmniki massacres, massive, in 1648, massive massacres of the Jewish people, and the utterly degraded state of Judaism at that time, impoverished, unlearned, and a sense of elitism of those who were able to learn, entered the figure of the Baal Shem Tov, Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov. This is not a real picture of him, but I just put it here as a placeholder. Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov is a wagon driver who revives the Jewish people, revives them with a sense of what we might call in a pithy way or a degree, but a folk revolution, an emphasis on prayer, on joy, on ecstatic service of God, on psychologizing the Kabbalah in a way that's meant to speak to everybody. Shabtai Tzvi is followed by a true spiritual revolution of the Baal Shem Tov within a century. The Baal Shem Tov's ideas go from fringe to something that has essentially dominated and brought in half of European Jewry, and it's still a movement of incredible force at this time. One that I might hasten to add animates my own practice of Judaism to an intense degree. Baal Shem Tov is also matched by the great genius, the Vilna Gaon. Also, probably not a real picture of him, but just a placeholder. The Vilna Gaon is the paragon of Lithuanian Torah study, of intensive Torah study, of connecting all of the Achronim, the later period of Torah study, and the Rishonim, connecting that all the way back to the beginnings of Torah, to the very verses upon which the oral Torah is founded. The Vilna Gaon and the academies and his students that they propagated, his student of Chaim of Volozhin, start essentially what we now call the yeshiva movement, with the great yeshivas of Volozhin and its offshoots, and the intensive study of Torah. On top of him is Baruch Spinoza, Benedict Spinoza, who was excommunicated by his Spanish-Portuguese Jewish community in Amsterdam for espousing philosophical ideas that were antithetical to Torah, and also marks the beginning of dangerous, at least to traditional Judaism, dangerous free thinking that finds really its culmination in this fellow, in Moses Mendelssohn. I believe he was born in 1749. Moses Mendelssohn is the father of the Jewish Enlightenment. While he himself was, I think, a practicing Jew, an observant Jew, a learned Jew, I believe that they say that all of his children married non-Jews and became heavily assimilated. He's famous for a line of "be a Jew at home and a man in the street." And he is the father of the Jewish Enlightenment and alternative ways of Jewish thinking. He writes important works. I believe Jerusalem is one of his works. And there's a counter-revolution to that emancipation, which is really finds itself in the figure over here. This is essentially a real picture of the Chasam Sofer. The Chasam Sofer is the father of a movement of a neo-traditional movement, which is a response to enlightenment, a response to emancipation, a response to the shirking off of traditional Jewish practice. And Chasam Sofer, one of his lines, are Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, play on words that says that the new is forbidden by the Torah. Of course, I'm collapsing huge biographies into very short pithy statements. But in a way, all six of these figures and many others represent the return of modernity, the return of Judaism in modernity, and the forms in which we practice it nowadays. We'll end off like this. I know I'm a little bit over time, but in 1894, a French Jewish artillery officer, I believe he was a colonel, Dreyfus, is accused of treason, and there's a young journalist at the time that watches the response of supposedly enlightened European liberalism and the way that no one quite stands with Dreyfus. You have Emile Zola, who writes the famous newspaper J'accuse, to accuse people and say, how can this rank, obvious anti-Semitism be allowed to fester in our ranks? And really exposes that after all the progress since the destruction of the temple and the initial anti-Semitism of the church fathers, Tertullian, as they moved away from Judaism, after this initial say, if you just scrape away at the surface of bourgeois society and supposedly enlightened society, you will still find the eternal other. You will still find the Jew vilified, hated, blamed, scapegoated, and seen as the object of hate for all of society's ills. And this young journalist realizes that there really is no answer except for Jewish return to their homeland, a safe haven for the Jews. That journalist was Theodor Herzl, who was a member of that bourgeois intellectual society. And Herzl writes Der Judenstaat and advocates for the establishment of a Jewish state. I have over here, and I believe I've shared with you, but if you'd like, we're not going to spend all our time on it. Herzl is not the first person, of course, to envision the Jewish return to Zion. You have the Chovavei Tzion movement, the students of the Baal Shem Tov and the Vilna Gaon, who are opposed to each other's ideas per se. Their students go and make Aliyah in the 1700s, in the 1800s. In 1777, a follower of the Baal Shem Tov, or of his student, Rav Dover, the Magid of Mezritch, Rav Menachem Mendel Vitebsk, settles in Sfat and in Tveria, and later on, the students of the Vilna Gaon leave Shklov with Rav Menachem Mendel of Shklov, and they make Aliyah as well. Aliyah was not so easy at the time. There was no Nefesh B'Nefesh then. And we find, leading all the way up to the Balfour Declaration, or the first Aliyah of 1882, Petach Tikva, the first permanent Jewish settlement, these all came before Herzl publishes Der Judenstaat in 1896 and has the first Zionist Congress in 1897. And the British Mandate begins in 1923. Of course, in 1929, there's the riots, destruction of the Jewish community in Hebron, which had existed for centuries. And in 1948, we have the Declaration of the State of Israel. The magnitude of this moment is one that cannot be overstated. Everybody in the Jewish world must react. And in a shiur I gave on religious Zionism last year, we talked about the gamut of Jewish impressions and reactions to the state of Israel, to this magnificent renaissance, a rebirth of a nation, a language revived as a spoken language, something that really has not happened. A language dies and it doesn't come back. A people dies and are exiled and they do not come back. The Jewish people, indigenous as they ever were to this land, do come back. Not all people have the same reactions. Some call it a satanic act. Some call it a divine state. And then there's all the reactions in between. Of course, I'm eliding one very, very big and terrible stop along the way. I think the mirror image, although I am very hesitant to draw links to them, the mirror image, the nadir of Jewish history since the temple, which is the, I don't think I pronounced that right either, nadir, I don't know how it's pronounced, but that's the Holocaust. Jewish, 1,000 years of Jewish history that we saw in that map of dispersal comes to a screeching halt with the Holocaust. And I'll say this about the Holocaust. And if there's one message about Holocaust education or going to Yad Vashem or any Holocaust readings, is that the Holocaust was not an aberration. The Holocaust was not that something broke and we have this terrible event. But I think the way that we look at the Holocaust is the culmination of those centuries of abuse and expulsion and pogroms and anti-Semitism that the Jewish people suffered in Europe. And the Holocaust was, when you scratched beneath that surface enough, in the most enlightened, in the most advanced, and the most brilliant of all societies of Europe, that's the society specifically there, is when all of the machinery of modernity is marshaled towards the extermination of the Jews, to answer the Jewish question in the negative. And if Herzl, seeing Dreyfus defrocked and accused of treason in a supposedly enlightened liberal society that was supposed to be tolerant of the other, the Holocaust was the one that made the need for Jewish self-determination so eminently clear. And it's something that we confront again nowadays. And the state of Israel and the Holocaust, I think, are the two poles of our experience as Jews that resonate 75 years later, 78 years later. It's exactly what resonates with us nowadays and animates our Judaism. There is not a single Jew, whether you are an ardent Zionist or anti-Zionist, whether you are deeply observant or not at all, whether you are fully aware and embracing of your Jewish heritage or not, there's not a single Jew that is not somehow informed by these two poles of Jewish experience of modernity and Jewish history. I'll end this class by saying that we've tried to encapsulate much of the Jewish story in these last two classes before we get more granular and talk about the books of Tanakh and the development of the oral tradition and move our way to understanding that tradition and the Jewish calendar in the coming classes. But I'll say like this, it is both a privilege and scary to be living in Jewish history. The days that we're living in now, the last 100 years have been some of the most consequential in Jewish history that have ever been, since we began as a nation, since the day that we accepted the Torah. There's that, it's said like a Chinese adage, a curse: may you live in interesting times. We live in very interesting times. We witness stories, like the stories we hear of heroism during October 7th, that I tell friends, I said, we are writing the Tanakh anew. We're writing stories of the Tanakh. If you read the Torah and the books of the Torah, there's stories of heroism, stories of depravity, stories of our enemies rising against us and us emerging victorious against our enemies. We're living through these times again. It's not that nothing happened in between in the 1,000-year intervening, 2,000-year intervening period. It's just that if you're aware and you're conscious as a Jew, you understand that history is unfolding before our very eyes. And as we become aware of our position in history, it allows us to act within history. So I bless us that our actions within the history that we're living, our actions that do justice to our pride and status as Jewish people, chosen not because of any supremacy or anything, that's not what the idea means, chosen because of responsibility towards our people, towards ourselves, and towards humanity, towards the entire world. And our hope is that Jewish history ends on a coda. Jewish history and Jewish messianism is, I think, unique in that it's not a redemption just for us, but it's a redemption for the entire world. And we talked about two Bate Mikdash tonight, two temples, but we'll see the establishment of the third temple. And that third temple won't just be for us. That temple will be a temple, Ki Beiti Beit Tefilah Yikarei L'chol Ha'amim. It will be a place where all nations will be able to serve God in unity and in complete understanding. May we witness, hopefully, a speedy telos of all this history that ushers in a new time, a new era of peace, of worldwide fraternity, of the Jewish people returning home, returning to ourselves. And as we deepen our understanding of Jewish learning in these coming classes and endeavor to push ourselves beyond our comfortable places of learning new things, even if we may have spent many years without quite knowing where it is, and this is the place to do so. And by embracing our Jewish identity and learning about it in a deeper way, hopefully we'll take that small part in realizing that messianic era. May it happen very, very soon. I want to thank you all so much. I want to wish you happy Thanksgiving.